This is Two Dope Boys and a Podcast. I'm Michael Brooks.
I'm Phil McKenzie.
Two Dope Boys is a shout out from the margins. Each week we break down trends using the lens of culture to shed light on what's significant to your future and why. How you doing this week, comrade?
I'm going to say I'm still moody just because I'm going to play a little closer to type. But nah, it's Christmas, man. We're getting close to the holidays.
Yeah, you're not moody.
I'm not moody.
Last week, you really did. You actually came into the studio.
Yeah, I had the screw face.
Yeah,
I did have the screw face.
It was very, very, it was very much like a kid that wasn't going to get like the extra G.I. Joe for Christmas kind of look.
With the Kung Fu grip.
The Kung Fu grip.
But nah, I'm good. I'm good. It's Christmas. Christmas is almost upon us, and even though I'm card-carrying member of the Black Atheist Club, I could still appreciate the holidays for what it is.
Is that like ten-person meeting?
No, it's a real thing, man. We're growing in numbers.
Yeah, you and Ta-Nehisi Coates.
Exactly. HU in the house. Thank you for that setup.
Well, now I realize
I didn't have to do it.
Every time you do the HU now, it's tough because now it's like I can't like Ta-Nehisi Coates now either. There's so many people you're taking away from me just because they grab.
The greatness of Howard.
Well, yeah. Anyways, let's talk about the greatness of the crew we have with us this week, Mr. Rob Fields.
Hey, what's happening, everybody?
Missed you.
Happy to be here. Good to be back. Happy holidays to the Two Dope Boys audience out there. Thanks for the continued support, y'all.
Happy holidays to everybody. Numbers, energy, everything is growing. Our communion events are growing. I want to thank, of course, super producer Matt Leck, Shauna Wan, creative director. Real quick, I'm just going to paraphrase the mailbag this week because there's a direct request from Eliza. Believe that's her name on Twitter. I'm sorry, I don't have it in front of me, but I know who you are. This is a tweet from Eliza J. Booth, and she basically just requested, I'll paraphrase, but when is the Nas Jay-Z debate going to happen? And I'm very pleased to announce that in the coming weeks, we're actually banking it this evening. So Phil and I are in our respective corners. Phil is preparing all of his gratuitous Brooklyn references. I'm calmly and methodically preparing the case for the obvious, which shouldn't be that difficult. And you'll be able to hear and... Sure. J.J. Evans gets ethered again, this time by me. And so basically you will be able to hear that debate shortly, Eliza and everybody else. And thank you for the tweet. Now we got to get to the brand F-up of the week. Phil, take us on that journey.
Brand F-up comes from Dropbox. This is pretty obvious, actually. This doesn't require a lot of setup. It would be helpful for those who are listening to this to get some visual setup. So
there'll be a link on our website.
There'll be a link on the website. And Dropbox was having what appears to be probably their holiday party, Christmas party. And they posted a picture of primarily, well, there's an Asian person in here, but a primarily sort of white crowd. And it says diverse with the title Diversity at Dropbox. And clearly a company with less than 5% African American, 6% Latino. This picture did not do a good job of representing diversity, at least in the traditional ways in which we might measure that visually. So Twitter doing what Twitter does went at them with a host of tweets basically lampooning this picture and the statement. So Dropbox followed up by saying that though they're making progress in hiring minorities this year, the numbers aren't where we want them to be. Then they went on to say that the picture was supposed to be more representative of gender diversity rather than, I guess, ethnic or racial diversity, since they are four women out of the six people pictured as shown in the picture.
The ladies work here.
Exactly. So there we are with Dropbox and their drive for diversity.
Yeah, it's 2016 and, you know, one Asian woman in a Silicon Valley company Christmas party is not really diversity. I mean,
In a lot of ways, this is old news. I mean, the whole Silicon Valley and its diversity issues are not new. So I don't know why I need to give this any rhythm here. It's like they're trying. I'm giving major air quotes here. But call me when you get something figured out. I don't know.
Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Two Dope Boys Pod to see Rob Fields' air quotes. He's a master of the medium. Yeah, I mean, you know, the only thing that struck me about this, I echoing both of what you said, is it doesn't surprise me at all. We know that this is a major issue in Silicon Valley. We know that more broadly, and one of the problems with Silicon Valley writ large is even just that, and I've had this conversation obviously with Phil many times and conversation with other people, including actually one conversation Phil and I had off air with Grant McCracken, is this lack of recognition. Wow, we've got battling cameras going on here. I love it. This lack of recognition within Silicon Valley itself that Silicon Valley is a culture and functions as a culture. This notion that they just exist in this sort of like platonic technology space, very devoid of all of these other questions. Right, exactly. So but I think the reason that we wanted to highlight this was it shows the kind of connection between that type of delusion and then not at least having people, frankly, in your communication side that at least can see the disconnect. And I think that, you know, putting this tweet out and this image out reinforces and kind of like close loops the problem. And that's why it kind of stuck out as a brand F up for us. But obviously there's no news here in terms of the problem in Silicon Valley.
There's no surprise, but I think it's just a general like tone deafness that I think people find both funny in a Twitter perspective, but then also I don't know if deflating is too strong a word, because that would assume that you had any faith in these people in the first place. But just is there sort of like they want to use these things to sort of thumb their nose at you. It's almost like, see, look, and then they still don't get it right. Like that's kind of how I took it.
What's
like,
your problem?
Exactly. Like there's sort of this, like they're digging their heels into their position without doing any real work to be more substantive in these areas. So that's how I took it. I'm not surprised by the attitude, because it's, again, a sort of a, you know, arrogant attitude to begin with. That doesn't mean it comes from a place of like malice, but it does come from a place of neglect, you know? And I think that's really what's more telling about this.
The unintentional malice. And that is the brand F up of the week. We got to get to What's Up.
Now we want to get to What's Up, and we're going to be talking about diversity. It seems like that's going to be a little bit of the theme of the night.
Ooh, Matt, quiet down.
But that comes from the New York Times, had a public editor piece from Liz Spade called Preaching the Gospel of Diversity but Not Following It. And I think the perfect setup for this is I'm just going to read the first paragraph, which is not long. And it begins, only two of the 20 plus reporters who covered the presidential campaign for the New York Times were black. None were Latino or Asian. That's less diversity that you'll find in Donald Trump's cabinet thus far.
Jesus Christ.
Of the Times' newly named White House team, all six are white, as is most everyone in the Washington Bureau. And then it goes on from there to discuss diversity as a challenge for the New York Times, which I think most would agree is the standard of newsprint journalism.
It's a paper of record for our country.
Yes, for our country, if not
beyond. Not my country.
There you go.
Yeah.
and
maybe not everybody's country.
And this was particularly like, it reads as a piece that is sympathetic and trying to raise awareness to an issue. But my initial reaction after reading it was that it falls really short of being relevant, only for the sake of the fact that these situations have existed for a very long time. And if you're in this newsroom or if you're in an organization where any of this is a surprise to you, then we have more deep work to do towards solving these issues. So of course, yes, they preach the gospel of diversity. They hold the feet to the fire of people like Trump, I guess, in referencing his cabinet, but then fall short of these same goals themselves. And my first reaction is, well, no kidding. Mm-hmm. You know, how do we now move past this pretty much water is wet sort of mm-hmm. realization to, particularly in these times, as we get toward these darker times, toward a more relevant solution-based set toward these issues?
You know, I'm married to someone who is a journalist, who teaches in a journalism department. I have seen this whole issue firsthand from a journalism standpoint, and sort of the stories my wife has told me, not only in her work as a journalist, but as a department member in a journalism department. More broadly, I mean, if you look at creative industries, as we were talking about off mic, advertising being the other one I'm very familiar with, it's always this issue of, or the line that gets trotted out is, oh, wow, we can't really find qualified people, or we don't know how to look. And yeah, this article does sort of speak to the, oh, we as the Times have to get beyond our comfort zone. Of the networks that we are comfortable in, but that again is it because people don't do that. That speaks to the institutional resistance. It speaks to the lack of corporate will to on the part of the Times to change this. I mean, if you just look down the street and see, BuzzFeed is like the Def Jam of journalism right now. I mean, they have so many killer reporters of color right now. So it's doable. Undefeated is doing a lot of great stuff with a highly diverse roster of journalists over via ESPN. So it's not that hard, you know, to find people who are doing amazing work out there. And so this whole idea that, you know, I think it gets caught up in these things where people get into this headspace of, well, not only am I going to be lazy, which I'll never admit to myself, and, you know, but I just want to keep the standards high. It always gets to be this question of standards. So we don't want to lower our standards. And I just don't know anybody who, you know, if we could find a Ta-Nehisi Coates, we'd of course hire him. Of course you would. How easy. That's a layup for anybody to do that.
Yeah, but he wasn't always that guy.
He wasn't always that guy and everything. He was talented. He had a point of view. But, you know, the Atlantic at least took a chance on him to allow him to nurture that, gave him a space to nurture that voice. And it's like, you know, it's the same thing that you know, I'm just going to talk from a black perspective. It's the same thing that we always have to be Sidney fucking Poitier, you know, guess who's coming to dinner to get a basic job. You know, someplace in a place like the Times, you know, whereas, you know, some other person, man or woman with less qualifications and a way lighter skin tone can kind of walk in there and be mentored and brought along and just given the shot to be up in there. And then all of a sudden it's like, hey, now they're, you know, features there. Like, you know, this article points out, the style section is one of the most infuriating sections for me of it all, because it's like such a, you know, white, and I mean that in a just like a, you know, a late to the party sort of no real flavor, and we're only talking to people who are really, really wealthy kind of section. And it's so clear there. It's just like, this isn't even interesting anymore. And it's, you know, I don't know.
I don't remember whether it was in the style section or not. I think it was, but I remember they did this piece during Sandy, and it was like, it's a risky proposition, but you could have pulled it off if you did it like in an Evelyn Waugh, PJ Woodhouse kind of style. But the premise was like, you know, everybody's preparing for this major catastrophe. And, you know,
what wines to bring up from your cellar in case of the flood?
No, literally, this woman was like, oh, we're actually flushing the toilet with old Zinfandels. It was like, it just got to the point where it was like, this is disgust. Like, it was unintentionally subversive, because after that article, you were like, all right, well, what we need to do is we need to burn down the banks, and people need to be dragged out of their homes, and we need to, and you know, maybe Pol Pot actually was a more creative thinker than I had thought.
Yeah. Gangs of New York
shit. Yeah, yeah. But, no, but I think. I think the that's an underrated, underappreciated Scorsese flick. I think the things that I want to add to this are, and this is a little bit, you know, what I think I could add is, I mean, one of the moments right now with sort of Trump and the broader context we're in that disturbs and really frustrates me among many things is we need to be at a point where we talk so much about all these different variables. So it's like the New York Times is still in the Stone Age with regards to racial diversity of its reporters, let alone other conversations I would want to introduce. Like, you know what? You could also nurture a talent of somebody who maybe didn't actually go to, you know, college. Right, like those people also exist.
Like that's where journalists used to come from.
Where they came from,
you know, there the is beat reporter, the
Cub reporter,
or the columnist now in you know in like the Daily News guys, scrappy reporter
that used to be a potential, you know, like a blue collar profession in some ways. Right. And I think, you know, when we talk about those disconnects and that art, and it's so funny because even the conversation on like, oh, we're elites and we're disconnected from the quote unquote, you know, America, which is a, I will never use that term. That's a, the implications of that term are terrifying. But even that becomes like another elite voyeuristic conversation. Like, oh, so what we'll do to get in touch is we'll send another beat reporter to a fucking Harley rally somewhere. They'll have no idea what's going on, and they'll get a couple of provocative quotes and write a stupid piece that doesn't benefit anybody. So, like, what just pissed me off when I read this is like, We need to solve for so many problems with regards to representation simultaneously, race, gender, class, background of all sorts of varieties. And we're still in a conversation that if people were serious, you know, even remotely serious, should have already been kind of fundamentally shifting decades ago.
Right.
And so that's number one. Number two, you know, and this is a broader conversation, but I also think that, you know, I actually, someone mentioned this to me recently. Apparently, I used the phrase like the conflict within whiteness. And one of the things that's interesting to me, especially with regards to this type of specific New York Times conversation, is what is the difference between people who, and I'll say specifically white people, who want to make it be known very publicly and in a very kind of, I have to say, often really melodramatic way that they quote unquote get it. And they care and blah, 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 versus just like the actual work of addressing serious problems. And I think that it shows up in a lot of these dynamics where it's like, you know, to me, and I'm not to pile on her specifically, but there's something about this that's just so reflective of a certain kind of like weird, lazy, racialized attitude too. And I'm not sure if I'm articulating it, where it's like, we haven't done anything to address like an actual concrete problem or the bare minimum, right? And then the response to it almost becomes like this column is almost like still a melodramatic treatment of themselves and their problems. Cause I'm, that's what I'm always trying to sort of articulate in ways like, can we just move away from all of the fucking melodrama and even just say, like, as an example, okay, the White House press corps under the Trump presidency. Well, this is a politician of the modern era. Maybe Reagan, actually. Reagan was pretty clear in his racial politics by, you know, where he announced the president and everything. But there's unprecedented in the modern era racial aspects of this presidency. So we need black reporters on that beat. That isn't like, oh my God, I need to assess myself. And I think we as an organization and I don't know. It's just like, no, that's the fucking job.
Yeah.
Do it.
Well, here's the thing.
You need more voices.
You need more voices, but you know, it's not going to change until it's tied to people's pay. So let's talk about what is really working, for example, in that I know is working in the marketing industry. It's like, you know, on one hand, you've got this push by some client-side marketers for their agencies. They're like, don't bring me – don't have – meetings where I'm sitting around and talking to I being the client, the fictitious client, am sitting around talking to a room full of white guys. If you do that, you're off this business or you're not going to be paid as well. And so pay is tied to diverse teams because the clients are beginning to understand that they need diverse teams to service to help them talk to the diverse audiences out there. Similarly, I just got this from, you know, in my day job, I work at a marketing trade association. And, you know, one of the things we're talking about is this issue of talent. And, you know, the question was for a chief marketing officer, how do you formalize your commitment to training and development, like internally, you know, and how do you make that real? And how do you make it so your boss knows that, hey, this is, these are the standards to which I should be kept? And, you know, one CMO of a very major company just sent me just like kind of the key things that he shares with his boss about what is his commitment to, you know, diversity. And it's measurable. It's like, you know, we want to always be looking for, you know, a certain number. It's not a quota, but it's like he's like on the hook for, you know, his yearly evaluation is, have you done a good job in terms of making your teams more diverse? Have you done a good job of making sure your teams get trained, you know, on what they need to do to feel like they can be a contributor? But that's in the CMO's job. You know, and when you start to put that sort of thing into the job of an editor or an editorial manager, saying it's not just about you making copy better, but it's also about, you know, acquisition and retention of talent, you know, because that's the other piece of diversity conversations is once you get people in, can you keep them? Is the environment
inviting? That's a corollary of making them think strategically versus tactically.
Right. So, you know, that gets tied to, oh, at the end of the year, when we evaluate how much bonus we're going to give Phil, like, let's look down the list. Okay, they did this many stories. They did this. And, you know, this is his commitment to, he said he was going to do this around diversity. Did he do that? Oh, you didn't do that, Phil. You're not getting this big a bonus as you thought. And
Phil's like, I don't care. I don't want white people here. Wallahu Akbar.
But how do we measure? Like, I think that brings up the argument about stakeholders. You know, like in your example, you have a client that could potentially drive the business. They can drive the direction of the business. The New York Times or any media organization, they're focused on clicks, you know, who's reading, their readership, their viewership, whatever that happens to be. And as you start to trace like where the reporting eyeballs are going, are they following stars? If you have that like Wesley Morris piece on black male sexuality and that's being read and downloaded and followed and tweeted and all that kind of stuff.
Or Hannah Nicole Jones on the whole school thing.
And I think that's what references that star system, where a lot of these mainstream publications are very comfortable having stars.
And it does obscure the issue.
And it does obscure. Yeah, and it hides the reality of the rank and file. If you look at a physical copy of the New York Times or digital copy of the New York Times, it's vast beyond the two or three stories that we might see on any given day. Like I consider myself a pretty well-read person, but I don't read a New York Times
cover to cover, right?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, I catch a couple of things and that's it.
Of course.
Right? Like, those things tend to be kind of star driven.
Right.
But I do care about the perspective of when I look at, to Michael's point, going into these dark days and I feel like a New York Times White House press corps that is not diverse in its perspective and its orientation is going to be doing a disservice
absolutely
to a business that is already willing to kowtow to yeah. autocrat.
Right.
And yeah, and again, I just keep making the point that I think it's like – and it applies really, really broadly to expanding the definition of who even goes into these positions really broadly to begin with.
Right. And it's also this whole assumption that, again, that, you know, a black person, a Latino person, a gay and lesbian person is not going to – bring the same journalistic standards. Like they're going to like be pushing their group's agenda in the pages of the Times versus being a journalist who can bring that kind of nuance to the coverage of a particular issue, i.e. it's the standards discussion again. And it's just like, stop it with this, you know, because again, the thing we joked about earlier, this sort of like default whiteness, and you know, whiteness is seen as something that is, you know, neutral.
Crystal clear.
Crystal clear.
And objective.
And good.
Well, I mean, I think that sort of goes without saying.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Look at my blue eyes.
So
not bad.
So you've got this. So you've got these set of assumptions that are at work. That, you know, it is the job of management and leadership, you know, and editorial leadership to say, well, hey, what are this range of candidates here who. You know, if we're considering a person of color or somebody who's LGBTQ or transgender or something like that for thing, it's like, what do they bring to the table? And more often, if they listened, and more often the cases, the audience would probably be there for them.
Well, the audience would definitely be there. But I also just want to – I know we got to jump on the segment in a second. But the last point that I want to make too is that the corollary of that is that, of course, it's a dangerous, deluded, and bigoted assumption that somebody couldn't bring the same level of nuance. But the corollary is that it's another thing. It's like everybody injects their values into, quote unquote, mm-hmm. neutral reporting.
Absolutely.
So that's another thing that we need to uproot. I mean, look, I'm an opinion an analyst, so I'm sort of open with that. But there's no doubt that my perspective on income inequality and class issues is certainly affected by the fact that I experienced homelessness as a kid.
Right.
That's a real thing.
Right.
So, and that's a good thing.
And that's called empathy.
And that's called empathy, and that's called a range. But, and it, of course, it affects my experience. But also, you know what? You know, I've spoken to many people, I'm not trying to throw them under, and from any different journalistic backgrounds. And it's like, they might be very smart, they might be very empathetic, but they just have no, you could run even the scale of like any modern issue, they have no personal experience of it.
Right.
My parents paid my loans off. I've never experienced X, Y, or Z. Mm-hmm. And that is in the copy too.
Mm-hmm.
So until we can realize that everything is in the copy,
right?
Then I think actually the worker's like, yeah, everything's in the copy. So have everybody at the table.
Yep.
That's obvious.
If you want to serve an audience that is growing more diverse every day.
And that's what's up.
Now we got to get to what's next. I'm joined by my two favorite line steppers in the world, my partner in crime, Phil, and core crew, Rob Fields. So we got to talk about basic universal income. And there's a pilot project in Finland, which I'm going to sort of use to set this conversation up. In Finland right now, I'm going to quote now, this is from basicincome.org, and then there's a piece in the New York Times. But it's going to be a small pilot program of about 2,000 experimental subjects will be chosen by using a random sample algorithm and contacted to participate in this pilot study, and participation is apparently mandatory. And the people that are going to be selected for this study come from a region in Finland where basically the job hits by the sort of collapse of Nokia as a company have hit this town significantly across all sectors, from the white collar to the blue collar. And basically, Finland has very generous social safety net system, but because of bureaucratic impediments, it's sort of safer to stay on your unemployment than, as an example, work on launching a new entrepreneurial venture. So the idea here is with this basic universal income – sorry, pardon me. With this basic universal income, you'll just deliver cash to these 2,000 subjects, And the notion is that it could be an impetus for a sort of reparticipating in the labor market. Now, basic universal income has across the board sort of ideological interest or buy-in to some extent. There's big distinctions here because there's been proposals on the far right of basically having some type of basic universal income, which would, but then getting rid of the rest of what in America is already a really meager social safety net. So it actually would end up being a net loss for most people of low incomes or even middle class people. And then there's just the notion that in addition to obviously things like healthcare, I would certainly argue housing, you need a basic amount of money to operate in the world. And I think this is another conversation that fits with the theme that we've had of like, what is the social infrastructure that we need to have to complement the gig economy and the freelance economy that we're all in? If we're going to have freedom, fluidity, and liquid economy, then we need a solid, stable, robust social safety net. There could be something we learned from Finland, but it's interesting to me that it's happening on the other side of a really healthy, robust, and higher standard social safety net. Versus if it came to the United States, where the safety net is sort of very limited and on sort of under constant assault anyways, particularly with this new administration. But I want to get your all thoughts on this, and I will start with the esteemed Rob Fields.
You know, this is an interesting idea, you know, and I think that we may have to see experiments in other countries and other parts of the world, because the idea of universal basic income does strike me as something that runs counter to the American myth that you're going to pull yourself up by your bootstraps and, you know, and somehow by doing that, you have the opportunity to be a billionaire like Donald Trump. The idea that you would get government handouts is somehow anathema to people, despite the fact that there's this thing called Social Security and Medicare, both of which people will draw guns on you if you try to take them away.
They're coming, though.
You know, so, you know, it's going to be, I think it needs, there's going to be some need to see the idea and explain it in a way. I mean, we've had so much of a debate lately about, you know, job creators and takers and all that stuff. There's this stigma that's always been placed on people here in this country who have not been able to, you know, create a company and take it public. You know, the welfare queen thing, you know.
Or people who haven't been born into trust funds. I mean,
yeah,
you
know, it's just like they're so lazy. Good. They didn't work. Their families clearly didn't work hard.
Mean, look, I picked the right sperm and I did a great job.
Exactly. So, you know, it's an idea that does on one hand speak to, hey, this idea that, you know, it would seem on one hand it'd be great in a country that is one of the richest countries in the world that we should be able to do this and prevent people from falling so far into poverty. And also, you know, as the article points out, there's this opportunity to give people a chance to explore things and do things that they might be more contributive to society. They might be able to have time to start businesses or whatnot, wherefore. And if you have the structure set up to help them do that, that could be really amazing. But I think there's still the social stigma that, and the political stigma, even more so, particularly as we go into 2017, that will be against anybody who's not just 100% trying to be an entrepreneur and make money.
I think you made a lot of great points. Like, both of you actually made a lot of great points. And I think what we're struggling with is a disconnect between a few things. One, most people have like a very poor to basic understanding of like economics and what the financial system is capable of supporting. Mm-hmm. So we put economics in this one very narrow frame. Then we put like social programs and others in another. And those are often tied to branding, when you talk about like this American myth, this idea of pull yourself up from your bootstraps, which has never been the case.
Correct. Everybody had help.
Yeah, everyone had help. I mean, things like the Homestead Act existed where you just went out into the Midwest and you put down stakes and you received a certain amount of land and money in order to kind of stake your claim to get people out of populated centers of the East Coast and beginning of the Midwest. But there's just a poor, I think, grasp of, like I said, economics, social, and branding, and then the reality between private and partner relationships. So everything that happens in the public sphere is perceived as being some sort of handout without understanding that private corporations, particularly in telecommunications, in defense, in media, make billions of dollars through government contracts, and none of that is ever perceived
and
as being a handout.
Exist without
yeah, they government. Wouldn't exist
the internet
without
is literally a byproduct of government investment.
Exactly.
And everybody is on the dole in some form or another, to the point where the whole even distinction set is completely irrelevant. The other thing, and I agree with you completely, the other thing that excites me about this just historically is there was a pamphlet written by Thomas Paine, who of course wasn't actually a founding father, but he was actually a global revolutionary, you know, came here, went to France, and he wrote a piece called Agrarian Justice in 1797, which argued that basically there should be an estate tax on people that owned land in order to fund public education, pensions for the elderly. This, again, is in 1797. And then also around two-thirds of the fund would go to – so I'm just going into specifics. Around two-thirds of the fund would be spent on pension payments of £10 a year for every person over the age of 50. And then most of the remainder of the fund would be used to make a fixed payment of – at the time it was £15, which was actually something – to every man and woman on reaching the age of 21 or legal maturity, basically just as like the beginning start. Mm-hmm. Like, and there's been proposals also along the lines of like baby bonds and things like that to people getting money out of the gate. And it's just it's a recognition of the reality you're talking about, Phil.
Yeah.
That everything starts from something.
Right. Yeah. And the world has changed. You're not going to, this planet and its resources, which are not endless, cannot continue to exist with us on it in the same way if you don't start to reassess this sort of industrial age capitalism that we measure everything by. You know, as long as we use metrics of a bygone era in a new era that's emerging, there's just less work. You know, like we constantly beat this drum, but it's a real thing. Like those of us who peddle in ideas, we have maybe it's a false notion that we can continue to do that as compared to those who, you know, they traffic in manual labor, which is going away, you know, and then the rest of the world is supported by our consumption that comes out of the West and the global North. And we are comfortable morally and psychologically with the idea that most of those people who create are rushed for flat screen TVs and cheap phones and all the rest of it are slaves. And so we're comfortable with that ideology without thinking that we are drifting more and more toward them rather than them getting lifted toward us.
Right.
And a universal basic income is a philosophical idea and an idea that is rooted in the reality that we can't continue to do the same thing and expect for all of us to make it. So it's like we got to get more comfortable with children of men, or we got to do something
that's right
different and better.
And it's a major opportunity, as I always say, for brands involved in either the disruptions that affect work or dealing, you know, with employment issues in the 21st century. You got to get on board with an agenda like this. It will rebrand how people view your business, and will also set up the infrastructure to allow the economy that you want to actually work in practice for a broad set of people. And then the other thing to always mention is that when we remove this kind of limited conversation around just work, it can open up a lot of space for, like, you know, how many people do we talk to who, you know, even like, actually, you know, Rob, it's funny. We had a conversation once, like, and obviously you are in, like, you're working, as far as I understand, I mean, you have one full-time gig, then you have writing gigs, you do a lot. But there's also, like, other projects that even you take on that, you know, you can't necessarily be compensated for because they're starting up or whatever. How much of that do we see in our lives of people actually solving all sorts of problems, creating all sorts of mm-hmm. new important opportunities? And we've relegated that to the point of, like, well, that's a passion pursuit or some nonsense like that. When actually a lot of those projects are essential to solving problems and creating opportunities right now. And if we created an infrastructure where people could go out and just do that and be supported to do that, the social dividends we cannot even fully appreciate. We could have, like, social R&D just by providing a basic universal income.
Yeah, and I think it's going to really come down as ever to how these ideas are positioned and branded. Again, we are going into these headwinds of, you know, America, what has come back into vogue, or what is coming into vogue as of January 20th, is really going to be about this sort of, you know, reactionary independence, capitalism overall, and, you know, the private sector knows best, less emphasis on a government subsidized, anything kind of government subsidized, I think, is going to fall out of favor. Although, you know, just in terms of the environment, not that people are not going to need it, but this idea of universal basic income and the opportunities that it presents is really going to, I think, probably be needed to positioned as a catalyst for innovation, as the thing that really drives, can help drive productivity. I mean, I think you're really going to have to be talking in terms like that to kind of sell this idea in the larger sort of like socioeconomic and political landscape. I mean, I think there are opportunities for, as you guys say, for brands to get involved and sort of help create that. But I don't think that is going to be coming anywhere from it remotely related to government, certainly not at a national
level.
Not
at all. But the thing that we need, but states can do it as incubators.
Maybe cities could take on some roles as a role of cities.
And as far as positioning it, though, I just think it's really important to say that, you know, what this government represents, and I say this as someone who in order for it to work, we're going to need to move to a fully hybrid economy that we don't even fully understand what that is yet. But even if I'm just doing my, like, you know, market friendly hat, this government coming in is not a market government. It's a cartel government. So right. You have to make the argument too that it is part of the infrastructure of actual anti-incumbent capitalism and the social infrastructure that supports it. Because what they're talking about and what they're doing is just reinforcing cartel capitalism and monopolies that benefit. Yeah, that's basically what it is. Yeah. And that is distinct even from the many excesses of even a cleaner market system.
Right.
And I think what got us to this conversation, we obviously expanded beyond the initial article talking about Finland, but it's important to understand, I think, from Finland's economic perspective that they have the leeway, the let in their system to experiment with some of this stuff, right? Because their economy, yes, they have Ericsson and all that kind of stuff, and that has kind of made them have to look at this stuff, but they have the money to do this largely because they have one of the, if not the largest, one of the top three largest sovereign investment funds in the world. So Finland, due to their oil reserves and their oil trade, when the price of oil was higher, their largely petrodollar economy, had been able to stockpile billions and billions of dollars. And I'm pretty sure they have one of the top three sovereign investment funds in the world. Uh-huh. And they're also fairly conservative. So they have some let in their system, and they have a fairly homogenous society. And as much as that wasn't referenced in the article, I think it's important because the, you know, universal basic income in a country like Finland is not really around racial or social divides that you would find in a United States.
Right, like the famous Rick Santorum thing where he was like, oh, we're not going to take your hard-earned money and give it to some blah people. So,
yeah,
you know,
like
everybody's sort of taking money from hard-working, white working-class Americans. That's kind of the way things get
there, played around. Everybody is pretty much
everybody's Finnish.
Like they have
all in this together.
They have immigration issues, but not even to the extent of like a Sweden, you know.
Right.
They haven't had that sort of history. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting. I think I just want to throw that in on the back end to say that places where these ideas can incubate seem to tend to come from places that are socially and culturally homogenous.
Right. And also smaller.
Smaller.
I think the size does matter. Smaller, which is why.
But relative to their size, with outsized economic resources.
Yeah.
Because, like I said, that sovereign fund
is kicking off
interest. It's the damn near like $1 trillion.
We have the resources to do it, no problem.
We just don't have the will.
Yeah, we don't. We have a misalignment of resources because if they handled their sovereign wealth fund the way we handle our resources, they wouldn't have money to do it either.
But it's also a relative to like just on a per capita basis, like they have a huge fund, much smaller population, and then they have less obligations. They don't have fucking military bases everywhere around the world.
They haven't been in a war for like 13 years.
Exactly.
We, even with all the bullshit, could still actually do it, but that's a tax question. But that's what's next. We got to get to the crates. All right, so now we got to get to the crates. This is our picks that make your life better. Something from culture, something from sport, journalism, something that is going to provoke some thought, create some insight. So this piece that I'm picking is a piece that came out a couple weeks before the election. And in some ways, it's really depressing because I thought it was going to frame the argument that we needed to have within, I guess, for lack of a better term, kind of broad Democratic politics. But it's by Matt Stoller in The Atlantic, and it's called How Democrats Killed Their Populist Soul. In the 1970s, a new wave of post-Watergate liberals stopped fighting monopoly power, and the result is an increasingly dangerous political system. And this article actually has a lot of lessons for businesses, because what he explains is how Watergate era and Vietnam war protesting liberals were defined, and, you know, rightly so in many ways, by that era in terms of like the problem was government, whether it was CIA overthrowing countries, a democratically elected governments, the war in Vietnam, or domestically the battles for, you know, social justice at home. And he sort of makes the point that somehow, though, this process got decoupled with traditional democratic concerns. Basically, the baby got thrown out with the bathwater, because there were also people in older democratic coalitions who were terrible on social justice and foreign policy, but from their New Deal era understanding, really understood the danger of corporate monopolies and power in terms of how it affected the economy and how it affected markets. So Democrats got to a point, following the logic by where through the Obama era they had made America, in some ways, obviously very fragilely, a much better place in terms of social emancipation and progress, but in many ways actually a much worse place in terms of economics and monopoly control of industries. There's a lot to it. There's a lot to unpack, and it's a really, really important article also because we're going to see like another wave of just aggressive monopolization efforts under this administration. And we talk about it from a social justice perspective on certain outlets, but from this show, we also are concerned with business, startup culture, and the healthy parts of innovation. And that's obviously also incredibly jeopardized by this. So How the Democrats Killed Their Populist Soul by Matt Stoller. There'll be a link to it in the show notes. Who's next?
I'll jump in real quick. I only have one piece, and it's an album, and it's George Michael's second solo album called Listen Without Prejudice, Volume 1. And it's going to be hard for people to relate to this.
From Arrested Development?
Was there a George Michael character in Arrested Development?
Yes, there was.
I've not seen one episode of Arrested Development.
So you're out here getting all teary-eyed about 30 Rock, which is, and Arrested Development is dope. I'm just saying.
I'll take your word for it.
No, it actually really is.
But George Michael, like there's what I call like the big four in like kind of pop music. Obviously, Michael Jackson, Prince, Madonna, and Bruce Springsteen. When I was coming up, those were the big four. Then you had sort of in that mid to late 80s, my argument is that like Janet Jackson and George Michael were the next two big, uber big pop artists. Like Faith as a record was huge. And when I was in high school, like George Michael was the first white dude that like, everybody loved. Like
we talked
black
about
chicks
this.
Loved him. Like they all had like it was Bobby Brown and George Michael.
Careless Whispers was the total complete shit.
Like Faith
that
was the
it.
Shit.
I mean that was Wham.
Yeah.
But that record was
huge.
Who is this guy?
Huge.
And you heard it on all the black stations too.
Yeah.
It was just like what is this?
That was when you had crossover.
Yeah.
And Listen Without Prejudice Volume 1 is the second solo album. And it wasn't as big as
songs
Faith.
Like what were up was on there?
Freedom 90 is on there. And he covered They Won't Go When I Go by Stevie Wonder.
Oh, wow.
Like it's a moody singer songwriter record, but I think it really shows like a huge range in George Michael's like talent, his songwriting talent. Dion Estes, which is his longtime bassist. Is behind a lot of the instrumentation. It's just a great record. It's different than, it's jarringly different from Faith. Like Faith had obviously huge dance hits and Listen Without Prejudice doesn't have that. But from a songwriting perspective, from a mood perspective, it's a jazzy record. It's one of my favorite George Michael records. I highly recommend it.
I can't remember if I talked about this last time, but because I'm having that kind of moment right now. And I'm reading a book called Uproot by Jace Clayton. Is this okay? Good. Then I didn't talk about this. So Jace Clayton, also known as DJ Rupture, got famous off of back, 20 years ago by being one of the first DJs to DJ off of three turntables. And he sort of came up through this sort of like alternative electronic kind of, world music dance scene. He's also gone on to, he writes for Bomb. He's written for a lot of places. And the book Uproot is really about sort of this sort of musical omnivore search for music in odd places around the world. Like he goes to the Middle East to hear how the Berbers are using autotune.
That's awesome.
So it's really a fascinating look at how, the clash between, in many ways, traditional sort of song and musical forms and modern technology and culture. And I couldn't remember if I'd said it the last time I was here because it's just taken me forever to read it. Not because he's a bad writer, he's an amazing writer, just because I'm not as disciplined to sit down and like just finish this book. I've been carrying it around for like 3 months around.
I hear you.
But it's called Uproot, and it's really a great book for any, if you're a music head, if you are, if you're somebody who appreciates sort of kind of a techno-ethnomusicological look at how music and technology are intersecting in the 21st century. It's fascinating. So,
sounds incredible.
Yeah.
Thank you, super producer Matt Leck. Thank you, creative director Shauna Wan. Thank you, Phil McKenzie.
Always a pleasure.
Comrade. Thank you, Mr. Rob Fields. It's been too long.
I would just say for your Jay-Z Nas sort of like dance off and everything, I think Who You With should be the intro music. Just a little like suggestion there, you know, to open that up.
That is so, that's perfect.
Who you with?
That's perfect. Follow us on Twitter at Two Dope Boys Pod. Follow us on Instagram at Two Dope Boys Pod. We're moving. Write us a review on iTunes. We got another several this past week. Thank you to everybody who's done it. Thank you to everybody who's written us reviews on Stitcher. A lot coming up in the new year. We're going to be doing our first live show. I'll tell you more about that next week. Thank you, everybody. We'll see you on Thursday for On Point.